Good afternoon, everybody, and thank you for joining us this afternoon for another BDS Monitor Live. We appreciate you accommodating the change in the schedule. We had a little bit of a change, and we, of course, welcome you for our call. We're going to have this afternoon the editor of the BDS Monitor, Dr. Alex Jaffe, addressing us this afternoon, talking about the end of the semester and the kind of observations that we're seeing now as we're ending the semester, coming to commencement season, and where we have kind of the direction of where BDS has been going and what we can expect going forward. There's a great deal to discuss and address, as many of you probably have seen from our latest BDS monitor. So without further ado, I will give the floor on to Alex. Just one note on housekeeping issues. As always, the format will be Alex will address the audience, and then we'll open up the floor to as many questions as people may have. If you are logged on through your computer, you see the hand icon. When you click on it, I'll be able to unmute you, and you'll be able to ask your question. Those of you who are on the phone may also have that opportunity. And we hope that you'll be able to also ask a question. If not, as always, you can always email us at bdsmonitor@spme.org, bdsmonitor@spme.org, and we could also read your question on online, or you could give us questions later on, and we'll answer them at a later date. So with that being said, Alex, the floor is yours.
Okay, thanks very much, and thanks to everyone for joining us today on what looks like certainly a beautiful day here in the New York area. I hope it is where you are as well. So let me cast a shadow over your day a little bit. I want to do two things. I want to do a little bit of an end of the academic year summary about the BDS situation, specifically as it relates to campus issues. Again, as Asaf said, as we are going now into commencement season, and I want to make a few tentative or hesitant suggestions about where we're going. And I think the question that I'm asked all the time, and as is Asaf and are many people who work on these issues, and that is, are we winning or losing? And so I ask you to keep this in mind, and we'll maybe be able to circle back to it at the very end. So let me give a little bit of a summary. There have been very few campus success stories for BDS resolutions in student governments this year. This past month, to about 2 weeks ago, California State University at Long Beach did pass a resolution, and this was accompanied by all sorts of protests and campus goings on. But this is really quite rare. Much more typical have been rejections this year. And as I tried to point out in the last BDS monitor that went out a few weeks ago, where there is the opportunity for a significant debate, BDS resolutions are almost invariably rejected. Where BDS resolutions are introduced at the last minute, or put forward or debated in various kinds of shady or underhanded circumstances, they typically are approved. And that's really my other point, is that this year has seen a lot more underhanded shenanigans on the part of the BDS movement, specifically Students for Justice in Palestine chapters on various campuses. So while at, for example, George Washington University, about a week or two ago, the student government rejected a BDS resolution after what I think is unbelievable, an epic 8-hour debate. Imagine having to sit through 8 hours of back and forth on this issue. At the University of Wisconsin, about a month ago, a resolution was put forward, a compromise was negotiated, and then as it got to be Passover, the compromise was tossed out the window by the head of the student government, and a resolution was passed. And then the student judiciary sanctioned the head of the student government, the president of the student government, for these kinds of shenanigans, changing the resolution, sneaking in a resolution with minimal debate on the eve of Passover. So the lesson, if we can generalize, is that, first and foremost, it is that eternal vigilance is the absolute prerequisite when dealing with BDS resolutions and activities within student government and on campus generally. That shenanigans are increasing. These underhanded efforts to introduce resolutions or vote on resolutions on Friday evenings, on the eve of the Sabbath, or on the eve of Jewish holidays, or as we saw at University of California, I think it was Irvine or Santa Barbara. You'll forgive me, I'm blanking out. On Yom HaShoah. There's no Jewish holiday or event that can't be exploited by SJP chapters and their abettors within student government in order to pass resolutions, but they're not always successful, and the backlash is increasing. What we've seen at a lot of situations is that boards of trustees and college presidents denounce these resolutions preemptively, and then if they're passed, they denounce them again. So the probability of these things having any economic impact is almost nil. But of course, that is not the primary goal of these resolutions. The goal of the resolutions and the goal of BDS activity on campus generally is to change the environment so that while we are in effect winning many battles, in a tactical sense, in a strategic sense, there is a palpable shift in the campus environment with regard to BDS and Israel. It has been normalized to a degree that was difficult to imagine even 2 or 3 years ago. And the other change that we've seen certainly in the last 2 years, and it's intensifying as things go along this year, are more incidents of anti-Israel harassment and even violence. We've seen it at Texas. We've seen it at Minnesota. We saw it about a week ago at University of California at Irvine, where former Israeli soldiers speaking on campus were verbally harassed and surrounded and had to be escorted off campus by the police. And not only explicitly pro-Israel, so to speak, speakers are being assaulted and marginalized. We of course have seen this on many occasions with so-called right-wing speakers. The Ann Coulter and Milo Yiannopoulos incidents at Berkeley are well known, but more recently in Washington State, Jamie Kirchick, who's a sort of, he's a journalist and a very fine writer, but he's explicitly pro-Israel. He's a leading voice against Iran, and wrote a book recently on the changing situation in Europe, and he's a very strong critic of treatment of women and gays in Muslim countries, and he himself is a leading speaker for that part of the gay community. He was preemptively attacked and marginalized as a so-called Islamophobe before speaking on campus. So there is a convergence, unfortunately, of opposition to unwanted speech, as it is sometimes called, generally on campus, particularly coming from sources that are identified rightly and wrongly as being right-wing. And pro-Israel speakers are being sucked into this vortex of opposition and intolerance and increasingly violence. At the same time, though, it's producing a kind of what I would call, I think there's a bit of overshoot going on generally with the anti-free speech movement on campus, again, into which opposition to Israel is being fitted, and specifically with regard to BDS movement. There are voices on campuses who are speaking out against the harassment of speakers, regardless of their position or orientation. And I sense, and I can't quantify this in any way, I sense that there's a certain amount of fatigue with the inescapable politicization of the campus environment by the BDS movement. There was an editorial by the editorial board of the George Washington University student newspaper saying, in effect, enough already. There's a proposal there. The BDS resolution was voted down after this monumental debate a week or two ago, but now there's a proposal that there be a campus-wide referendum next fall so that the issue can be taken directly to the people. And the student newspaper is just saying enough already. And I think that there are whispers of this kind of frustration here and there going on. And it's certainly palpable with respect to free speech. And there is in other areas where we have seen campus protests getting violently out of hand, there is a real economic price to be paid. The most notable example is at the University of Missouri, which has closed something like 4 dorms and is reducing its reducing staff members by several hundred because students and parents just don't want to go there after the violent Black Lives Matter protests of last year. And the more that the BDS movement hitches its flag to these in a so-called intersectional fashion to these other movements, I think there will be a price to be paid. But because it's a form of anti-Semitism, It will continue to morph. It will continue to graft itself onto other movements. And because the goal is not of peaceful coexistence, but rather a kind of utopian end state where the mythological enemy of Israel and its supporters are somehow completely vanquished, it will never ever go away. It can only go up and down according to various, let's call it, market forces and political forces. So let me turn very briefly then to a couple of predictions, and some of these are fairly jejune or bland. Again, because the BDS movement is anti-Semitism, it's going to morph, and it's not always possible to predict precisely. I think in the next academic year, we will see more resolutions because they know how to do that, but we'll also see more efforts at having campus-wide referenda, because these take place outside of the controlled environment of the student government debate, and therefore I think the pro-peace, pro-Israel movement has begun to learn how to address that controlled environment. These things have to be expanded, or let's call it internationalized, to use that metaphor. So I think we'll see more of that in the next year. I think we will see more violence and harassment directed against Israeli and anti-BDS speakers, and it will be of a part with more violence directed by other factions, other movements against opposed to the free speech of whomever, and this will produce more of a backlash. And unfortunately, I think all of this is being increasingly set against the backdrop of opposition to the Trump administration and its various policies and the person, the personality of President Trump himself. And regardless of how one feels about these issues, I think this is going to be a broader context that has to be addressed. And there will, of course, be more intersectional alliances with other movements, Black Lives Matters, Native American and other indigenous movements. But I think actually there are hints that there will be a more productive, from the perspective of the BDS movement, alliance to be made with efforts to have universities divest from fossil fuel investments. And because this is something that is nominally apolitical, and it latches on to the climate change narrative, which is, regardless of how one feels about the issue, has become a kind of article of faith on college campuses and within the broader respectable left, not simply the far left, the unrespectable or disrespectable left. So I think we're going to see more of that, and that's going to be a much harder nut to crack, much harder issue to oppose. Excuse me, because these fossil fuel divestment proposals or resolutions do reach boards of trustees more readily than single issue tendentious, obviously political and tendentious issues like BDS, or intersectional demands for more diversity coordinators and dormitories exclusively for one racial or ethnic group or another. These fossil fuel issues, because they have again a real economic impact, and because they speak to a broader, so presumably apolitical narrative, I think are going to get more traction. We've seen already at least one or two petitions which, in in their list of demands or considerations do mention Israel and Palestine somewhere towards the bottom of the list. And our side has to respond. Our side has to come up with reasons why these things are not the same, at the very least, and should be, everything has to be considered separately. So are we winning or losing? As always, it's both. We win some battles. Whether we're losing the war or not remains to be seen. The campus environment is changing, not for the better as a whole, and because our issues are always set into those broader issues, it's very hard to say where we are in the war as a whole. So with that, let me stop, and let's take some questions.
Great. Thank you, Alex, very much, as always. So the floor is now open to questions. Again, those of you who are logged in through the computer, you can click on the hand icon, and I will call on you, and you'll be able to ask your question. You can email, or you can also raise a question on the phone as well. So the floor is now open, and feel free to ask questions. Let's move on to any other questions that we may have on the phone. Alex, while we're waiting for people to ask questions, why don't I take the prerogative and ask a question? Many people on the call and have been aware of the latest events that have been happening at Dartmouth as a result of the appointment of the individual who has been a member of the Native American Studies and has allegedly signed on to the 2013 Native American Studies supporting BDS, which we've seen and have written about. Of late, we've heard from the Jewish Studies Department at Dartmouth that there is confusion, about whether or not he actually supports BDS or not. And they claim that, of course, they claim that he is not an anti-Semite. And you've heard distinctions between kind of soft pedaling between the anti-Zionism and anti-Semitism in that case. There are a lot of reports that have been coming out in the campus and out of the campus. And there's individuals on the faculty who stood up and said that this is blatantly anti-Semitic. What do you make of that? And do you see that as a growing problem as far as, and especially in particular to regarding departments of Jewish studies, where you've seen a lot of the defense come out in support of that?
Okay, well, there's the general and the specific, and obviously I don't know the faculty member in question personally. I've read what he says, and I've read what his supporters and detractors say, and I think it's a very tough call. I think that the process has played out in kind of a positive way. That here's an individual who, said things or endorsed things in the past, who got called on it, was forced to clarify, defend, backtrack, however we want to put it, and who has his supporters and his detractors. And now the issue is out in the open, and I think that that's a positive thing. I certainly don't have any inside information about how it's going to play out. The unanimity of the Jewish Studies program at Dartmouth regarding the individual suggests to me that they don't feel as though they had to come to this guy's defense, that they're being they would otherwise be held hostage by him if they didn't defend him. but that it's genuine. And you know, people, anyone who's worked in or around academia knows that political issues like this are common and go very, very deep, and there are always personal dimensions as well as professional, intellectual, and political dimensions. So I have to reserve judgment about the specific case and see what else comes out. On a broader issue, though, I think it points to a structural issue, and that is that BDS supporters, either stronger in the stronger versions or the softer versions, if we can make these kinds of distinctions, excuse me, are all over academia. They are numerous, and they have and will have positions of responsibility as deans, as department heads, as program heads, as provosts, and so on and so on and so on. And it is necessary to be vigilant. It is necessary to be aware. And it's regrettable. It's extremely regrettable that it's come to this. That we have to. Anytime someone gets a position, their name should be. Somebody should Google their name and see where they stand on this issue. It doesn't mean that they automatically have to be opposed or should be opposed from their appointment as a dean, a provost, or something. But it means that there is a possibility that they will bring their tendentious politics into the performance of their duties. And that's just where we're at. You know, that side politicized the campus environment, and we all have to play by those rules now, because from my perspective, from our perspective on this side, we know that pro-Israel faculty members are routinely treated with less than fairly within their departments and programs and colleges, and precisely on the basis of their politics, and okay. we have to be vigilant. So let me leave that there.
All right, thanks. Our friend Charles has a question. Charles, can you hear us?
Yeah, can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you. The floor is yours.
Great. So just a couple of points for you and Alex and everyone who's listening. I think we need to work also on the rhetorical flip of the attack and the assault against Israel and her supporters. And I'm frustrated by continuing to have to hear all this defense after they have launched assault. We are responsive instead of taking the offense, and I think that we ought to think through what an offense might look like, and just on one foot, it should be they're lying about the Jews again. These are just lies and propaganda. It's a whole PR campaign, and it's paid for by the Arabs. And just to get that out there in some way. Also, I wanted to mention that if people don't know, we've made a film called Hate Spaces all about this. And we've been screening it around the country, and we're soon to, and even on campuses. And SPME people have been on the panels, Jonathan and Miriam. And it's quite good, and the effect of it is good. So if you go to hatespaces.com, you can see it. That's my commercial. And finally, it seems to me that we ought to think about an overall strategy of picking one of these fights to have a smashing victory. And I suggest that we select one, which is winnable, and get everybody who's our ally in the entire pro-Israel universe to agree that we ought to put aside whatever else we're doing for a week or two and really lend resources to blast the hell out of this particular one and make it a national case. And I think, A, unless we go on the offense, and B, unless we more strategically organize against them, we're going to continue to be faced with responding defensively and maybe winning, you know, here and there. But as Alex quite rightly pointed out, the tide is against us in the sense that even when they don't win the votes, that's not what it's about. It's about changing the atmosphere to being anti-Semitic. So I'll end with that.
All right. Well, let me thanks, Charles. Let me respond very briefly in not the order that you mentioned that. Certainly the film should be seen and seen widely. So we'll start with an endorsement. Regarding a winnable fight and working together, as you and I both know, and many of the people who are listening at home know, it's very difficult to get people on this side of the equation to work together in a concerted way. And there are political and sociological and political economic reasons for that. I agree it's worth doing. The other side works together much more readily, although they do actually have their own fights, but that's a topic for a separate occasion. I don't know what a winnable fight would look like, although I have to say on that basis that the fights that have been won in the last year, the fights that have really changed the environment, structurally changed the playing field, have not been fights that academics per se have been engaged in, but they have resulted from the involvement of the lawyers who have applied anti-discrimination laws against groups like the American Studies Association. Again, this is a terrible, terrible position that everyone is in, that everyone has to be suing at this point. But I think that those have made the real changes. At the same time, and somewhat in the same vein, I think for all you lawyers out there, that there are more lawsuits to be had directed against Students for Justice in Palestine, Muslim student associations, on the basis of using racketeering statutes and conspiracy statutes, conspiracy to deprive people of their rights to free speech, conspiracy to commit violence and harassment. Again, it is an absolute tragedy that in order to maintain free speech on campus, one has to sue the people who are trying to shut it down. But I think that that's actually where we're at. Finally, with regard to the rhetorical question, which is something that you and I, Charles, have discussed for many, many years, and the difference between defense and offense, I think the problem now and has always been that our side is responsive, or for the most part, we have better things to do than sit and craft offensive messages, as the other side does continually, against a particular ethnic group and national entity. That's simply not what we do. And from our perspective or standpoint, that would be both offensive and not productive. I agree with you wholly about the summary that you gave, you know, lying again about the Jews. But the problem is that that anti-Semitism is a concept that that again morphs physically or socially and rhetorically. And I think it's going to be very difficult. And this brings me to, I think, the salient point, is that because narratives of Muslim victimhood are ascendant in the world and in American society and on campus, I think it's going to be very difficult to craft an offensive message that says what perhaps should be said, or that tells the truth about the nature of the BDS movement and its attack on Israel, that it is essentially a Sunni Muslim quasi fundamentalist message that is adopted by communists and socialists, and witness the problem that people have been having with Linda Sarsour lately, a New York BDS personality who's become an icon of the far left, and who will in a week or two give a commencement address at a branch campus of the City University of New York, and who was perhaps unwittingly and certainly stupidly endorsed by a New York senator, Kristen Gillibrand, and who's appeared on Comedy Central shows. It's been very difficult to get any traction against her, despite the fact that she's a hater who hates Muslim feminists like Ayaan Hirsi Ali, as well as Zionists, and as a BDS supporter, and who's basically a Muslim fundamentalist herself. So it's a big problem, and I don't have the answer for that.
I have the answer.
Go for it.
I have the answer. Yeah. I mean, you say this is not something that we do, and that's true, but we better damn well get to do it, because the entire narrative hinges on who they really are and how they have captured the left. And if we're not, I mean, the biggest shame of the Linda Sarsour moment is the silence of the ADL and the AJC, et cetera, who have decided not to do that fight. But we haven't decided not to do that fight, and we simply don't know what would work until we try something more than an occasional article. And I'm suggesting, yes, I'm suggesting a big, big campaign to turn the tide and the rhetoric around. And I agree with you wholeheartedly how difficult it would be, and how conflict averse most Jews are. But I think we have no choice. But we can discuss this later.
All right. Well, thank you both. Let's have another question by Jack Seidman. Hold on. Jack, can you hear us? Jack, can you hear us?
Do you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you. Go ahead. The floor is yours. Yeah.
So, not so much my issue. What is the possibility of putting out? Let me backtrack. The main issue on campus, aside from pro-BDS agitators, is the abject ignorance of so many students at these universities about what the issue is, what is going on in the Middle East, what are the roots of the conflict, what are the possible solutions, what is the possibility of putting out a top 10, top 20 list of objective books dealing with the conflict and dealing with the history. Like, one of my main sources in the papers that I publish is A History of the Israeli-Palestinian Conflict by Tesler. Another one is Palestine and the Arab-Israeli Conflict, the one that has the actual source documents in there. I think it's by Smith. But everyone doesn't know these books. And the student population needs to know it. How can they have an objective look at what's being put out without something like that?
Let me first of all agree, but there have been efforts in the past by various organizations, including Middle East Forum and others, to promote lists of better books and critique the worst books. The problem, I think, is that students, there's a general problem. That is that students are raised to be less than curious, but there's also a very specific problem, and that is that instructors assign their own books, and they expect students, really in all institutions, to read those books or sources and regurgitate what is expected. And the problem has been all along that, and there have been numerous documented cases of this, is that students, when they stand up to a faculty member and say, "This is not correct. Your characterization of the Arab-Israeli conflict is not correct. Your characterization of the Muslim treatment of women is not correct," or whatever, which is very rare. It almost invariably puts that student in hot water. And there was a case in Florida at the end of the winter where some student objected to what his faculty member was saying along these lines on these issues, and found himself suspended because he had been accused by the instructor of threatening and harassing her, and he was reinstated, and she eventually resigned, something like that. The problem is that the atmosphere on campus is just not conducive to freedom of thought, freedom of research, and that we can produce and push out all sorts of lists and all sorts of other resources. Lots of people create packaged resources about the Arab-Israeli conflict. Stand With Us makes very nice pamphlets and flyers and posters, and as do many other groups. And maybe students read them, and maybe they don't, but very little of it is useful in the classroom, because the ethic in the classroom on the part of the student is to give the teacher what they want, and vice versa. And I don't know how to reverse that. Again, our problems are situated within larger structural problems of the university as a whole, and in a period where everyone is holding everyone else hostage on campus, where a small minority of students can hold an entire institution hostage, and where a small minority of faculty members who are cruelly tendentious about whatever issue it is can hold students hostage, we have a very dangerous situation. And I think until people start voting with their feet and voting with their wallets and don't go to those institutions, and where alumni make their objections known to institutions like, let's say, Oberlin, as alumni have, and university trustees get the message and administrations get the message that harassment will not be tolerated, excessive tendentiousness won't be tolerated, then outside influences, outside materials will be of fairly limited utility. I think that students would be much better served in some respects to just be turned loose in a Barnes & Noble and given a gift voucher for books that they can buy and then read. than actually attend many classes. But that's maybe a little hyperbolic on my part. So I don't know that answered your question. I don't mean to be negative, but I don't see easy solutions or ready solutions.
I understand, and I thank you for the concern you put into that answer. I've read these other lists, the pamphlets and everything else like that, and my main issue is that they're not objective, and you know, they're more of the preaching to the choir type, and they're easily taken apart, which is why I'd love to find lists out there of objective material, like my book. No, just kidding on that. But there's got to be a list of, or something out there that people can read that is objective. So much is propaganda on one side or the other.
I think we live in an era where objectivity is reviled as both a practical and philosophical possibility, and that's the problem. And more objective resources certainly do exist. And I'm sitting here staring at one of my bookcases, and it's filled with books, which are great. But you have to get people to read them is the problem. And I think that's the real problem is, I don't know how to get people to read things anymore.
Ah, yes, that is, unfortunate.
So.
Thank you for that. That's indeed a larger problem that we have to deal with all around, not only on our issues, but in the who's reading what and if they're reading all together.
I had a maybe we could just close on this point. I had a professor in graduate school many years ago who used to say that if you don't read everything, you feel as though you're missing something. And if you do read everything, you're disappointed. And I think, that's sort of an old school 1980s vision of things. And now, if things can't be reduced to the space of a 140 character tweet, there's even less possibility that it's going to be read at all. So perhaps on that basis, let me thank everybody for reading at least some of the excessively wordy BDS monitor that we send out every month, and as well for sitting through so far 51 minutes of conversation on these issues. That is heartening. So we appreciate it.
Well, thank you, Alex, for that. And again, thank you all for joining us. As always, we are here to help and deal with these issues. Obviously, they are complex. There are different methodologies and thoughts about how to tackle this very vast and complicated problem. But we are seeing some measures of success, but it requires a lot of dissecting particular problems and particular campuses. Unfortunately, it's going to be an ongoing issue, and we are heartened by the fact that we have faculty and many faculty that are members and a non-faculty as well who care deeply about these issues, and that's really why we are here. So Alex, really thank you for your comments, and we thank all of you for joining us this afternoon. Should you have further questions, comments, our email is bdsmonitor@skme.org. We will continue to have these calls and to produce our BDS monitors, and we look forward to continuing the conversation. As we're ending the semester and Memorial Day is nearing, I wish everybody a happy Memorial Day, and at least the weather is shaping up. Of course, we look forward to continuing the conversation. So thank you, everybody, and have a good afternoon.